I'm really sorry, so I'll try to scream back there. But this is our second presentation in this room this morning. We're really lucky to have two great speakers, Charles Rochal and Melinda Kearney. Charles is going to be up first, and he's going to give you a brief overview of creating a brand. Charles works for Brand Advisors, and this helped us, the Vines of Mendoza, create our brand. We're really lucky to have him. And then Melinda will finish up. Melinda's from Napa and owns her own consulting company on wine marketing. So she's going to help specifically with wine and creating the brand and marketing and labels with wine. So enjoy.
Thank you. Well, we're glad to be here. Thank you for having us. We really had a whole lot of fun. I mean, how can you possibly imagine having a job where you get paid to go to Argentina and drink wine and eat lavishly, other than having to come back 10 pounds heavier? It's not a bad thing. And the crew here is an absolutely wonderful crew to work with, and you all, I look forward to meeting you today. What I've been asked to do really is to talk about how we can help you all commercialize and sell your wine. And the reason why I'm here is for the last many, many years, I've had my own branding firm and have worked helping small companies and large companies build brands. And so what I want to talk today a little bit about, and forgive me because one of you have a different level of experience in marketing and branding, but I'm going to try to bring it down to a fundamental level just so that everyone can be on the same page. Because if you all indeed want to market your brand, you can take it as seriously as you wish, or you may not necessarily want to take it so seriously, but you might want to do a few things. But we'll at least, if nothing else, walk away today understanding how great brands are built. And should you want to apply this in your own businesses or otherwise, this is something that I think you'll enjoy finding interesting. So I would start off by saying, you know, would any of you be interested in this piece of property here? Who would buy this land? How does that look to you? Does that look appealing? Well, that is your property, folks. That is the finca circa 30,000 feet, 2003. And, you know, almost 10 years ago, these two guys, one with a very bad haircut, for a man as handsome as he is, Pablo back here, and Michael, came together, and they had this big dream. And I spoke to many of the owners here and folks who actually came here, and some of you maybe yourselves did the same, coming to this area where there was literally nothing but desert and nothingness other than raw beauty and the terroir that makes some of the best wines in the world. Now, you know, some other people had different visions, you know, as some of you may know, Uko. But really, the interesting and the powerful thing, and the thing that's so great about this organization, is everything that Michael and Pablo have said they're going to do, they've done. And lo and behold, many years later, the vision is reality. And really, what's so compelling to all of you, I think, and why you all are here, as we understand it, is that all of you in one form or another had a dream at some point to own a vineyard. Maybe you didn't even know you had the dream, but once you were exposed to this wonderful situation, you thought, my gosh, this is a pretty incredible thing. And so from that, you all now have become, more or less to the extent you wish, you are the farmers of Mendoza. And despite being fully supported, as you are with a company that's got 1.9 million grapes and has produced 230 fermentations, you all can be as involved or as uninvolved as you wish, but it's an exciting thing. And so here we are. As a result of your work, you produce your grapes, and you may have 3 acres, you may have 10 acres. And at the end of the day, you know, this is the reward of your work is this beautiful wine. So, of course, you drink your wine, you know, you drink a little bit more wine, you give some to your family, you give some to your friends, you give a little bit more to your friends, and the next thing you know, you may have a few more bottles left. And so that leaves us today with, well, what are we going to do about that? What's the opportunity? And the opportunity really is that you have an opportunity to actually commercialize and make some money selling your wines. The U.S., many of you owners are, about 80% of you are all from the U.S., so I'm going to speak mostly about the U.S. market. Of course, the principles apply elsewise. But the U.S. is the largest wine market in the world. Imports have grown almost 50% since 2001. and the market itself has grown 19 years in a row. So you're in a good position here in the United States in terms of the demand for really great wines. The challenge is here are your bottles sitting on the shelf, but if you zoom back and realize that there are 7,500 wineries in the United States, and how many brands and wines that they produce and the marketing muscle behind them, that creates a challenge. And in any marketing, in any branding, the fundamental premise is how are you different and relevant in a way that people are going to want to purchase your product or service? And, of course, in the world of wine, depending on the person who's drinking it, wine is a very difficult thing to differentiate in terms of even a palate. Most people don't necessarily have as sophisticated palate that can really distinguish between wines, but some people can go into a restaurant, and if I took a $200 bottle of wine and a $50 bottle or a $20 bottle of wine, and I put it into a $200 bottle of wine and poured it from that, some people wouldn't necessarily know the difference. And so in many ways, there's a lot of marketing in wine is about perception, and yet what we believe in is it's not just about perception. Perception in the image is a result of everything you do. It's the substance as well as what you offer as well as what you communicate. But it's harder in wine because there are so many competitors. It's harder to differentiate. So how do you build strong brands? That is really the question, and that is the way to succeed. And the way I always think about it is products are made in the factory, and many companies talk about their quote-unquote brand as the leading provider of enterprise software for the Fortune 500. They describe their product as opposed to describing what the value is behind it. And because it's so hard to differentiate product per se, especially in a category where it's hard to distinguish, it's much more important to have a brand that represents an idea that's something of value to who you're targeting. And so where products are made in the factory, I say that brands are made in the mind, and they're the collective sum of everything that you've ever encountered with that brand. And if you had no experience whatsoever, if you were dropped off of the planet Mars onto the planet Earth, and you tasted a wine, oh, that would be one touch point. You heard someone talk about a wine, that might be another touch point. You look at the label, you read an article, you read a review, you learn who the winemaker is, and all these things collectively, as you learn more and more, are going to be feeding into your perceptions that are going to end up in your brain as image. But image is not about marketing. It's about everything you do, which includes marketing. But it's more important about what is it you're going to deliver of substance. And so great brands have a promise that's relevant to your targeting. And it's both rational and emotional. And in a category where you're, if you're going to a doctor and they fix a broken heart valve, the rational solution is you want to get someone who can fix that better than anyone else. In the emotional category, in luxury goods, in many cases, you're playing off of emotions. And it doesn't mean they're mutually exclusive. The second thing is if you're not different, then it doesn't matter. You have to be not just relevant, but also different. So it's not just what you do, it's also what you say and what you do. And then third, independent of what you offer and what you communicate in terms of the value proposition, personality. Now imagine going, do you all know the French Laundry up in Napa?
Yes.
So imagine going to the French Laundry and I can say, good afternoon, my name is Charles, I'll be your waiter this afternoon. Our specials include the following. And we have the beautiful white tablecloth and the Spode china and the Riedel crystal. I could serve the exact same food on paper plates, Dixie cups with no presentation. I could come in cutoffs and a t-shirt and say, hey, what's up? I'm Chuck. Got some great stuff for you today. And it's the exact same food. But your perception of that being served on a picnic table on a Dixie cup, in a Dixie cup on a paper plate, and a guy that has that tone doesn't fit the image of French Laundry where you're paying $450 a meal, right? And so the environment, the price, the food, the presentation, all those things lead up to the perception of what makes that brand, and it would be inconsistent to serve it in the other way, though it's the same food. Now, if I was charging a lower price, and that would be more consistent of the kind of an informal type of a tone and personality. And finally, it's consistency over time and over points of interaction. So everything you do is communicating. So when it really boils it all down to, it's like, well, what does a brand stand for? And you can't be 20 things. You have to stand for one big idea. So you think about cars, for example, Volvo is about safety. If I said FedEx, you might say overnight shipping, but frankly, when FedEx was in business and we rebranded Federal Express to FedEx, there was FedEx, there was DHL, there was UPS, there was Airborne, there was Emory, and everyone was offering overnight shipping. And so what we said was, You know, you've got to capitalize on the fact that you created the category. You're the leader, and you want to, and you're really delivering confidence and trust because you're sending the most important package. So really, owning the category is taking the name that people created to own what the category actually is and own FedEx, because people talk about time-sensitive shipping is FedEx. And that brand is about peace of mind. And you pay more because you trust them, because you're going to rely on them. So how do you build brand? You have to have a blueprint. And like we all often want to do remodeling without hiring the architect or the designer. And then we do it, and then we realize, oh, God, we shouldn't have done that, because now we've got to do it again. That's going to cost more. The same thing applies with brands. If you establish a blueprint, so to speak, that aligns and gives focus to what you stand for, then everything you do is going to be focused, it's going to be efficient, and particularly when you don't have a lot of money to spend, everything you do has to be purposeful, because no matter where someone experiences your brand, you want to make sure they're interpreting what you've determined to be important and relevant, which is how you define yourself. And so this is the model that I created, which says that you're looking outside at customers and competitors as well as yourself and understanding where the opportunity, that's your blueprint. And from the outside in, not just thinking about what you want, but from a customer market standpoint, you got to think externally, what matters to them, what's going to be different and relevant. That's the big idea. And then from the inside, what we've done here is to try to make it simple to say everything you do is going to ultimately impact brand perception, starting with your product and your people and who you hire and how they behave, and persona, what is the personality of how you communicate, process. When someone puts an order in, do you call them in person? Do you send them an email? Do you send them a handwritten note? All the little details that add up to reflecting back on who you are and what your brand's all about. It's ultimately going to be tied to a name and a logo, but ultimately all these things that are wrapping around it are what's more important, what you do and what you say. How you promote your brand, packaging, labels, websites, communications, place. Where do you choose to distribute your product? I mean, do you want to sell in Costco or do you want to sell at Dean & DeLuca? Right? I mean, that's a big distinction, and Costco's not going to necessarily want to carry a $300 bottle. Well, maybe they do. That's maybe not a good example. But in terms of a premium brand, I wouldn't necessarily want to put a special limited boutique brand that you all have in a place necessarily that's going to be where you want to command a premium price and just differentiate yourself from. So that's the setup, and Apple is a great example of a brand to make this point clear. Apple addressed the problem that the PC market had, which was PCs are complicated. They're not imaginative. They're, in fact, they're the followers. They've always followed Apple, right? And it's always been the safe decision to buy IBM, you know, the PC, right? So what did Apple do? They said, we're going to create a brand that's going to unlock the potential, and we're going to democratize computers. That's what they did 30 years ago. And so how do they do that? You know, you set up your brand with a big idea like enabling personal expression. And that may be a stretch for you all, but if they define themselves as the leading provider of computers to the graphic arts community, right, or the computer provider for the education environment, how would they have done what they've done in music? Or what they're doing in every other aspect of the world. And I continually am looking 5 years ahead, and they're going to be in home automation, and they're going to be allowing us to do things that are impacting our life at a much broader level than they already are. But, you know, you think about being able to create your own slideshow, you know, be able to then create your own music through GarageBand, and then all the way through to now to be able to have a face-to-face conversation through FaceTime and everything else surrounding it. So it's about simplicity versus complication. It's about creativity, innovation versus being the follower. It's about individualism. It's about empowering the individual. So even when you think about that and you start looking at what they do, you know, the iCloud, iMac, iPhone, there's a reason why it's a naming system, and it's a way of cohesively communicating about individualism, right? To look at the billboard here. There's not even any words on it. But you know it's Apple because, if nothing else, why do you know that's an Apple billboard? Why do you know if you can see it? Maybe you can't see it too clearly.
The iconic product.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not like, well, let's see, the market has black headphones, so we're going to do ours in green or blue. No, they chose white for a reason. White, because white is simplicity, pure, clean, simple. It stands out. So they don't even need to put it, they're so simple, they don't even need to put their name on the billboard. And generally, I'm the biggest stickler about companies that don't put their name, because you go, who's that billboard for? You don't even know, right? But in this case, important. Simplicity, what's more powerful? Having a thing in the wall that says, we're simple, or having beanbag chairs on the floor with two-year-old kids using the computers, right? You know, individualism. Do you want to sign up for AppleCare? By the way, not customer service, AppleCare. Or do you want to go to the Genius Bar? Or do you want to sign up for one-on-one training, which is going to, when you buy a computer for $100, you have a year, you can come in as often as you want, and they're going to help you learn how to use your computer, enabling you, right? So that has nothing to do with the product. It has everything to do with the overall experience of the brand. And even to the extent that their stores are so exciting that people actually come there and hang out. I mean, it's a place where people gather and hang out, right? So the point I'm making here is that people typically think of their brand here. What are we going to do in marketing? But it starts with here. A computer where the laptop or the power cord is magnetic and pulls out so you don't pull it off the floor. That's thinking ahead, right? That's thinking differently, right? To who you hire, the services you offer. To, oh, by the way, we have to name the things, but let's make it a cohesive story that all wraps around. Even the bite out of the apple, I interpret that as like, you know, it was the Adam and Eve, the individuals who dared to be different and take the bite out of the apple, right? No religious commentary here, but just commentary around the idea. Mm-hmm. The Think Different campaign, even the tagline was that you go, think different. Shouldn't it be think differently? No, it was think different, because it even caused you to pause and be thought-provoking about the idea. So, simplicity, creativity, and personalization. Personality, as I said, French Laundry, they're accessible, they're fun, and they're inspiring. And so that's how they do it and what they do. So all of you, as you think about creating your brands, the more you can come up with and be disciplined enough to come up with the big idea about empowering individual expression, enabling individual expression, defining these things that are going to drive what you're doing, as well as defining the personality, that's going to make you successful. And these things have got to be defined in context of who you're quote-unquote competing with, right? And in some ways, you're not really competing. But if you want to market and wherever you're trying to get into, whether it's a restaurant or a local wine shop, you got to understand, why are they going to want to carry you? You're going to have to give them a good reason why. Maybe you've got a relationship and you get it in there otherwise, but that's the idea. So the process, the first thing is you got to figure out who you want to sell to and understand who they are, what they want, what they need, and customers and competitors. The second is then figuring out, based on that, what's going to be your relevant promise that sets you apart in your personality. The third thing is you just got to bring it to life. And part of it is, it's not saying you go backwards, it's saying looking at what you have now, what are all the characteristics, strengths, and assets that you have, including many of which is your association with the vines, right? All the things that you can collectively associate, because that's where the wine comes from. And then communicate it and continue to deliver on it. So, for example, friends and family, is that where you're going? Are you going to restaurants? Are you going to retailers? Wherever you may be going, be thinking about that. And even as far as channels are concerned, we'll talk about it in a moment, but one of the channels you have is even through the vines, because the vines has a private vineyard owner website section where your wines can be sold on the site. So then you get into the promise, and you know, most people, they want to be global, innovative, worldwide, all these attributes. They want to be 25 things, but I'm making clear is that what's so important is being focused. Being focused and clear. And boil it all down. Being externally driven, not like, I want to be this. Well, you want it to be something that you're proud of and is a reflection of you that also overlaps with what the market needs and what the competitors aren't providing. Focused, again, is being owning one idea. And then third, you know, being really trying to play off both the rational and the emotional benefits. So if I can help you all just to begin, some of the things you can be thinking about, and all of you are on the same level playing field, is some of the brand promise elements you have is you've got incredible product quality. And you can talk about the fact that you have Santiago as the consulting winemaker whose wine was the number 10 rated wine last year by Wine Spectator. Pretty good, right? As well as some of the owners who have had wines rated are in the 90s. Pretty powerful. The second thing is, what else can you look at? So positioning is all relative to everybody else. So in fact, I think two Argentine producers import about 40 to 50% of the wine into the U.S., or they export 40 to 50% of the wine out of Argentina. So even in that context, is also as relative to other domestic players, is you're a small batch handcrafted wine, right? As opposed to the large, effectively almost commodity-like examples. And third, another thing to play off of is you are what you are. You're an Argentine wine, and be proud of it. And the Uco Valley is one of the most preeminent areas of winemaking in the world for the last 450 years of making wine in Argentina, right? So those are some things that you can start with, but then, of course, you want to go beyond that to the extent that you can, and you can tell a story about it, and it's relevant, and it reflects you and your values, but also what meets the needs of the market. So then, how do you bring it to life? You start off with a foundation. You know, you need a name, you need an identity, you need messaging. So you need to talk about what's your verbal representation. How do you verbally define your company? This is this brand name. You might have a tagline, you might not. You have a graphic identity, a logo, and then you have a look and feel. And that look and feel applies to it's not just a logo, it's a logo on a package, on a label, on a bottle, on a website, etc., etc. And the second thing is then you take all this, you take the foundation and you start applying it to all the component pieces of communications. But beyond that, as I said, and it's harder as spending, especially since this is not your full-time gig, but the customer experience is really one of the things that we're focusing a lot on helping with working with Michael and Pablo on what are the things that we can do that are meaningful to continue to play off of the things that we've understood to be important to all of you and to bring more focus to that. And so, if you think about it, it's a continuum. You think about defining your brand and some of the things we talk about, small batch or independent premium quality. The second thing is the foundation of the name, the graphic identity, messaging, stationary collateral experience. And then you start building awareness and understanding of that which you've determined and defined already. You've defined what you want to be and what's relevant and important. Then you start delivering it, these things for the website, through search engine optimization, through events, and all the other little details that come into play, right? So if I come back to the model here and you start thinking about product, people, place, process, persona, you start thinking about the product, you start thinking about where you want to distribute it, restaurants or wine bars, you start thinking about the associations of people, and you start taking what you have as well as what you can add and build into this so it all ties together in a nice little bow. So it's simple. People don't have time to process a whole lot of stuff, so boil it all down. Here's some of the things that that we can even show from some of the current owners that what they're doing right now. So this is a website from one of the brands here, and they have this little line there that says exclusive wines created with only you in mind. So they've got some copy, and they've done a little description, and they've created their own website. Building awareness, again, you all have access to the owner's collection area on the website from the Vines of Mendoza. And here, there are 3, 6, 9, 12, 13, 14 of the owners are represented here. Not necessarily all of them are active, but it's a very powerful asset to take advantage of. And in the case here, for example, we're going to use Newnham as an example. When you click onto this, there's a template that's set up where you've got your label and you've got your story here, and then you've got your products and you've got your pricing accordingly. Secondly, just thinking about search engine optimization, if you want to get into this, it may sound a little bit more complicated, but basically when people type in your name or your names, you want to be thinking about how you can drive people to where you want to drive them to, and even pay for search keywords where they type in a certain word. If you pay and bid the right price, your name will appear first, and it'll allow you to click through to take that to a website, yours or someone else's. And in fact, the Newnham folks are actually they've got a Twitter social media site. So there's Twitter, there's LinkedIn, there's Facebook. This particular brand, they even have their own website. So rather than clicking on Newnham and going to their own little thing here, these guys take you to their own website. And that's something else. Ultimately, it's probably as far as sort of the most bang for the buck, you're probably all going to need some kind of a basic website. If nothing else, to tell your story and click here to contact us and learn more and purchase our wine. So just in closing here, to give you a quick snapshot of what we were doing for the Vines, to give you a frame of reference, I mean, this is the state of the Vines, and as they have grown tremendously over the years, I mean, I think the big challenge was we're doing all these incredible things, and we're making wine, and we're starting a winery village, and we're getting a resort, and we have all these things, but how do we really sort of boil it all down to what we're all about? And so when we actually focusing first on just the folks, the owners themselves, what we understood, and hoping we're going to hear the same thing from you all, but we talked to a number of owners, and what we really understood is that you're all very passionate about wine, you guys are adventuresome and active, you're risk takers, you're pioneers, you want to be at the forefront. That's why you're going to Argentina, because you want to be able to go someplace that's new and different and exciting, as opposed to going to Aspen or the Hamptons or wonderful places, but this is something that's a new horizon. You love to travel, which is important because that's part of the joy of being part of this program. Experience driven, so the rich experience that you can have through any kind of experience such as this is wonderful. You're financially secure enough to be able to make this investment, and people are generally really, really nice, and it does work well because they think about wine and food as sort of the social lubricant of connecting people, right? You sit around a table and you have a civilized meal. So what we really understood to be the things that were most important and distinctive of the vines is the degree to which this is a personalized thing that you all, we can't even count the number of ways in which your wine can be personalized for all of you, down to 500 liter stainless tank, up by Malbec versus a 5,000 liter, toasted oak from Europe, of my cab, all the way down to packaging and labeling and all the way through. The second is that you can be as involved as you want, but you're fully supported. And I think that's a really important thing, because you can be as involved or as not involved, but you've got the very, very best people, from client services to relationship, etc. And not to forget Brian back there. Pardon me, I just went too far. The third thing, the high quality. We can't take away the importance of the high quality, and particularly for the value that you're getting, given what it costs to buy a vineyard here, for example. And finally, that you get this insider Argentine experience. Because these guys, you've got the Argentine and the American partnership, and they've been here for 10 years, they're able to take you up into the Andes on a 7-day trip. They're able to take you to other wineries and visit the art scene. They're able to take you fly fishing. It's an incredibly rich, rich experience. And so really, what we boil down the idea of ownership is really about pride and joy, is that we want you all, and we think that you all, and what we heard from all of you is that there's a great sense of pride in owning your vineyard, and there's a great deal of joy that comes from it, not just in owning it, but in being involved in it to the extent you are, and in sharing it. And that then we think about defining it, the vines in Mendoza as a parent is more than an extraordinary place, it's a style of living and being. Rooted in the pleasures of making, drinking, and sharing wine, the vines immerses you in the delights of Argentine cultural, natural beauty, and warm-hearted hospitality. So that's what the parent brand's all about, and what the private vineyards is about is the vineyard ownership experience you've always dreamed about. Work side-by-side with world-renowned consulting winemaker Santiago Chaval and our expert team to make your custom small-batch wine. Jump in and get your hands dirty, or leave the details to us. Along the way, we'll shape Argentine's magic like only a local can. Revel in the pride and joy of making your wine your way from your vineyard. There's nothing else like it in the world. Does that resonate with you all? Does that make sense? Because this is not meant to be fluff. This is really meant to be what is a reflection of what this brand is all about and the value it provides, and even the style and the tone. Not meant to be flowery language. It's meant to be straightforward and direct, but true. And from that, we then developed an identity system, and we're focusing here much more on the look and feel than the experience, but taking that identity, and what we said was, the whole inspiration was this notion of this multifaceted, rich experience. We played on the layers of, from earth, rooted in the soil, to water, to vineyards, to sky, to mountains. The idea of layers played off on the beautiful design element of Argentina, of this horizontal stripes, and then making it more distinctive by incorporating the mountains, which are the Andes and are so traditional and characteristic of the place, that makes it so special. And what we also found in comparison to others, and I could spend hours and hours here, but if you look at the other players in the category, they're either very traditional, like Eau Fournier, very serious, and everyone pretty much looks the same. Or you look at some of the very contemporary, and what are they doing? They're showing full bleed photos of these beautiful, perfect shots, but no people. And what we said was one of the most important things here is you've got to show the people, because, and not only the people, but the people engaged and active in what you're doing, as well as engaged in with your relationship with the people from the vines, because that is a true relationship, and it is something special. And let's also not be so perfect. And I call this design structure, unstructured structure, which is, let's not look like everyone else, but let's be reflective of the fact that nature is natural and unpredictable. And nature, which is the very essence of what the brand's all about, is organic. And so even you think about the layout of the story here, you start looking at the layout of coffee and type of crop pieces. But also about simplicity, because the personality of this brand is about laid-back luxury. And it's rustic elegance. It's that paradox of being super, super premium, but comfortable. It's like you don't have to worry about getting dressed up to go to dinner, right? And the identity plays out through language, through experience, and everything from even taking that identity element and even translating it into the materials, the palette there, and then going beyond in some of the experience things, which I don't want to give away the secrets, but that the team will be sharing with you over time. So that is it for me. I appreciate your time, and I'm going to hand it over to Elizabeth.
Melinda.
I'm Melinda. I don't know why I keep saying Elizabeth.
That's my middle name, though.
I don't know why I'm... Excuse me, Nindy. I'm so
That's
sorry.
That's okay. It's right there on your desktop.
Is this it right here?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Here you go.
Thank you. Do you mind if I start these things?
Well, amazing. That's a wealth of information if I've ever... in the presence of, wow, branding God. So I'm Melinda Kearney from Napa Valley. I've lived in Napa Valley for 25 years. I moved from Boulder to be in the epicenter of food and wine. Love food. I was in the restaurant business and needed to be in Napa. So 25 years ago, moved to Yountville. And immediately got into the restaurant business, the wine business, from the restaurant business. And since then have worked with 16 different wineries. I've helped launch 9 new brands. I've done packaging and branding and sales strategy for 2 of my own brands, one of which I still have. And so I've been blessed to work with some amazing terroir, some amazing winemakers, some really brilliant owners, and concepts, and so I feel I'm very excited to talk to you today, because I think you have so much that brought you here to create this pioneering spirit, as Charles had described you, and I think it's just amazing that you've gone to Argentina to be, you know, in the wine business. It's just delicious, really. I've worked with wines that have, the price points have been $11 all the way up to $225. I've worked with wineries that have made 85 cases all the way up to 65,000 cases. So the common theme with all that is that the wine needs, every brand needs a story. So I work with my clients to create an overall long-term message that reflects their commitment to their brand, where all of the elements of the brand work together and promote the message, but really ultimately what are we all hoping for is to sell the wine. So I'm here today because Rob Lawson, do all of you know Rob?
Yeah.
Okay. So Rob, a friend of mine in Napa, recently visited a winery that I have been consulting for the last 3 years. Up on Pritchard Hill, which is, well, the Wine Spectator called the Pritchard Hill Napa's Rodeo Drive. So neighbors are Colgan, Bryant, David Arthur, Continuum, Chapelet, Ovid, Montagna, Gandona. So this is kind of a Tony neighborhood. It's starting to become recognized for its specialness. It's up above the clouds. There are some very unique and special physical characteristics of this land. There's red soil, there's elevation, there's a moderate temperature swing. There's sunshine in the morning. If you've been to Napa, which I know you're going tomorrow, you know, if you get there before noon, likely, you'll be sucked in by fog. Now in Pritchard Hill, they're above the cloud line, so it creates these concentrated berries. It's very special. So anyway, the wine coming from Pritchard Hill is of an elevated stature, price point, the and so the elevation of presentation and the elevation of experience is all was all necessary for us as we developed my client's brand, which, by the way, is called Brand. So Rob visited Brand Napa Valley, which opened last year to great fanfare. We released 218 cases, and the wine sells for $225 per bottle. The wine will grow from 218 likely in the next 10 years up to about maybe a little under 1,000 cases. We'll likely have two equal wines, the wine that we're making now, which is a Cabernet, and then a Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon Blanc. So there'll be two wines that kind of carry the property. It's 110 acres total, with 12 acres planted to grapes, Bordeaux varietals. So I was brought in 2010 to help the owner of this property, which was not named at that point, other than the vineyard was called Feathered Horse Vineyard. I was asked to come in and help him elevate the experience, elevate the presentation, do the branding, the packaging, and create a wine from that property. I, of course, am not the winemaker. Philippe Melko is the winemaker. He was hired in soon after Ed Fitz, who was the owner, purchased the property in 2006. So just to back up, just to tell you what we're going to talk about today, what we did with Brand is we aligned it with its raw assets. We transcended the obvious. We developed the story in an authentic way that created an emotional connection, and we developed the visual assets that helped tell the story. I mean, from driving up the driveway to drinking the wine and finding it on the shelf somewhere. So, clicker.
There.
Thank you. So, what is Brand? Brand was purchased, the property was purchased in 2005 by Ed Fitz. Ed is a packaging industrialist. He created the cardboard solutions to the styrofoam clamps for McDonald's and the paper that the hamburgers were wrapped in and the French fries. So he created, had a large business which he sold. His focus was on customer service, and so he has brought that to what we provide at Brand. His hobby was raising gypsy vanner horses in Pennsylvania. He had a breeding operation there, and gypsy vanner horses, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they were rare in the United States. They were traditionally the Romanian gypsy cart, the horses that pulled the gypsy carts in Romania. So Ed had this desire to, as I said before, kind of raise the game. When he landed on the property, I don't think that he totally understood where he was. He had an amazing view. He had this beautiful red soil. There was a lot going on. And then he realized that his next-door neighbor was Ann Colgan, and up the street was David Arthur, and started getting acquainted with the neighborhood and the wines that were being made in the neighborhood. And realized that he needed to up the ante of the thoughts. So, where we began. So these are the things that we knew. We had the beautiful gypsy vanner horses.
We had horseshoes, which were used in other parts of their businesses in the horse breeding operation. This symbol, they really liked the symbol. They wanted to use it in their branding. We had red soil. This is a photo of the cave inside at Brand. We have red rocks. All the vineyards on Pritchard Hill need to be blasted. And these red rocks come out of the soil, and they crush them up, and they haul them off. But there are so many rocks. So everybody's got red rocks. It's a massive investment to plant vines up on Pritchard Hill. There's a view. We have Ed and Philippe Milka. So all those things were in place when I came on the picture. So we identified these. There were all kinds of other things as well, but these are the things that really meant the most. There were 3 acres of existing vines on the property when Philippe came on the property. They made some experimental wine from this vineyard called Feathered Horse. Realized that the vines needed to be replanted. They had not been blasted properly. The vineyard wasn't quite up to what was necessary in order to make the wine that of comparable quality to the rest of the neighbors. And so Ed had made a commitment to replant the vineyard, to build a winery, and to create a wine and market it under a brand. So we began. So I've been talking about the expectations of the neighborhood. So we have price points of, you know, $400. We have, we had this Philippe Milka. You know, you can't make an inexpensive wine. You can't just kind of fall off the rock and show up. So, you know, we had a level that we needed to maintain. We had some themes from the ownership. There was a horse theme. There was a Western theme. There was, the red soil, the rocks. There was, you know, there were all kinds of things that were going on. Ed wears Lucchese boots every day. So there were, you know, things that I could see that were kind of tactical, and actually that was very helpful because it created kind of some guidelines and boundaries to the work that we were going to do. We weren't going to go into horticulture, or we weren't going to go into, fine art. We were going to stay within this. These categories. But the job here is not to just go for the first thing that comes up, like the horse. So the vineyard had been called Feathered Horse, but that to me wasn't going to be the name of a wine that was going to, for $225, how would we sell a wine with a horse on it? So that was I helped to guide them away from that. So we were, the job there was to transcend the obvious. So how could we, or in other words, how could we get from there to there? So that's the label. So we did some exploration. We explored the gypsies. We went, in books and images to Romania. We looked at the carts. We saw this beautiful imagery. We saw these gorgeous colors, and there's so much history and texture and legend, and there were words for luck and words for, you know, we had these horseshoes. So that was an angle that we explored. We made lists. We took languages. We did all kinds of really kind of fun, we took lots of fun exploration. The other angle that we took was looking at the farrier, the blacksmith tools. We have an anvil. We have the tack for the horses. We have the ancient farrier's tools. And so we spent a lot of time on those things and took names and words. You know, we had lists for all of these different topics, basically, that related within that circle of conversation. And we started to see, and then, of course, we had this red soil. And and the rocks. And so the red soil is formed by volcanic eruption. And so how that goes is that, you know, the volcano comes and erupts. These giant boulders come up, fly into the air, and of course they're heavy and they land. And then the ash comes down. And so it kind of fills in. But when you're ripping up a vineyard, that's when you find these rocks. Anyway, so and then in the soil with this red are veins of iron. And so it's just really incredibly beautiful. I had a slide earlier where the, let's see if we can go look at that, because it actually, right here, is the, in the cave. And so from head to toe is this red soil, and there's a there's a vein of iron that runs through it. And so that soil was so incredibly compelling that we needed to pay attention to that. And then look what's next to it, the horseshoes. So thinking through, what's a foundational element for a horse? Horseshoes, right? The horseshoes, if the horse is on good footing, it's healthy, good configuration, balanced, and stable. So on Pritchard Hill, what are the vines planted in? This incredible red soil, colored by iron. So we found this element, it was iron. And through, and I don't want to scare you, 8 months of conversation, determined that the horseshoes were going to be the symbol of this brand. And during the conversation, you know, with things like this, you know, you can do all the work and you can let it sit and nothing really stands out, and then one day you just approach it differently. You walk into the room having had tomato juice instead of orange juice, and your point of view is different, and the conversation, something about that day is magical. And so from this, these symbols of the horseshoes, I can't even tell you how it happened, but we decided that that would be the symbol of brand, and that we could use it as a branding iron. And then after that, we went from trying to figure out how to call brand in a different language, because who would call a wine brand, right? And in that conversation, that magical day, Ed said, you know, I really like this, because I love... our goal for this was to have a simple name, one syllable, strong, memorable, and with meaning. So why don't we just call it brand? I'm American. I speak English. So let's have this be English. And so it just became brand. So then we had to go and find some sort of visual identity for this. So we took the horseshoes, and the name, and the story of the mirroring foundational elements, the horses and these passions, Pritchard Hill, grapes, this new winery, and then the horse breeding operation in Pennsylvania. And those two things were meaningful, and we took that story to David Hughes from Level in Calistoga, and he spent a lot of time with Ed, talking to him, listening to him, asking questions, and so there was just this discovery period. But David also is he's a very good listener. Ed's a very good listener. And he came through very early on in the process with the beautiful shape of an upside-down cowhide. And he took brand, the name, he took the horseshoes and in a very subtle way made a brand in the center of this shield. And we spared no expense on the printing, on the embossing, on the debossing, on all of the paper, the quality of the bottle, for example, the tissue, the sticker, the packaging. I have brought a box. So it's a cedar box, not a pine box. There are no joints. The joints are tongue and groove. So all of the assets that we took from the goal of creating a handcrafted, beautiful wine from a very high-level neighborhood. So David, that magic where I feel, and we all felt, that this shape of the label, number one, super unique. You could, now you know brand. So if you see it again, you'll say, oh yeah, I saw a brand. It's not like it's on the shelves with 218 cases. You're not going to see it at Costco. Right, Charles?
I don't think so.
there was just this magic, and it said more with no words than anything that we could have said on a back label, for example, or in any of our marketing. And so it's a symbol. It transcended. It went from, as you remember, we went from there, this beautiful, passionate horse, to there. I'll get this clicker one of these days. So then, Charles was very wise to advise how to take the branding and make sure that it translates through all different things, from your the side of your building to your Twitter handle to the symbol on your Instagram account to your stationery to the glassware. We have a table with brand on it. We have, you know, our sign. We've got a beautiful one of the Pritchard Hill rocks with brand and the horseshoes. Our boxes, there you see them, and here are two of the embossing treatments there down there. Trademarking and a commonly used name such as brand is a little problematic, and so we, before we dove in and actually printed the labels, we confirmed that the trademark would go through, and the way they handled that was to take the symbol, so the brand and the horseshoe together in this configuration, and we were able to trademark that. So we felt safe enough to go ahead and do that. And, so there are risks, but at the same time, once you start using it, it's yours. So let's see, what else do I want to tell you? So it's kind of the story. What we did, and I'm going to plug this here. So what we did, we aligned brand with its key assets. We identified the key assets. We transcended the obvious. We told a story that was authentic to the owner, something that felt good to Ed. For example, the art that started coming in from his personal collection was beautiful Native American, a beautiful painting of a Native American girl and a sculpture of a Indian chief dancing and a saddle from an old antique saddle. And so these things had already been in his collection. None of us knew that, but these things, so what we did was he was successful enough in communicating who he was, so the brand was an expression of him and a very comfortable expression, which is amazing. So for a long time, we really wanted to make sure that there was no horses, for example, in our branding. We didn't want to be a horse wine. But we do have, in June, coming some real horses to live on the property, which is as we come full circle, we'll have not gypsy banners, but a few beautiful horses on the property. So it was a wonderful project to work on. I'm delighted to have been involved and helped to nurture this process along. And anyway, I would love to, and both Charles and I would love to open this up for questions and offer anything. I'm going to start passing around a little book in here with some labels that I've worked on, some identities and things like that. And then this is Thomas Keller's magazine called Finesse, and this just came out as the design issue. David Hughes, our designer, is featured in that, and there's a little tab in there, and you'll see brand. You'll actually see my Label Lorenza in there too. And then Continuum, which is also on Pritchard Hill. And then, here's the some of the packaging. So, cedar box, which smells great. The cork, and then the bottle. So, anyway, thank you.
Can you give me a ballpark number of how much you think he spent on that brand and what role that you described?
Oh, gosh. Couple hundred thousand dollars, probably.
Could have bought a couple of vineyards.
Maybe. But probably the amount of time. $100,000? Yeah. Label design, somewhere between, and all the assets. Yeah. Yeah. Website design, et cetera,
et cetera. For those of us who don't have a couple of $100,000 to spend on branding?
Yes.
Which I'm one of. What would you recommend that we think about doing relevant to the things that you described?
I think what's most important is to just be absolutely clear about the things that are really important to you, the things that make you comfortable, the things that are really resonate with you, because as soon as you're in your zone, you know, with your, you know, when you feel great about what you're doing and it's a story that connects with who you are and why you're there, then how that all happens. There are, I think that's the clarity, and then I think people can help you execute the process on various levels. But yeah, that's a good question. That was, he was fortunate to be able to spend that. Yeah.
Sometimes I feel as a consumer that I get kind of overloaded with, I don't know, who's the brand, but not your brand.
Yeah, sure.
Just with a brand, you know, where it's like, okay, they have it on the label, they have it on the bottle, they have it on every piece of thing that you can see. But I think it, at one point it goes from trying to send a message to just being overwhelming or kind of what I would say tacky.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk a little bit about how do you determine at what point is enough versus too much?
Do you want to do that?
I think at the end of the day, we're all overwhelmed with information, period. Your identity should be present in the appropriate way in any given application because you want people to know who you're dealing with. But I don't want to put a name tag on my forehead. I've introduced myself and there you go. If I'm at a new event, I'm going to have a name tag on my lapel. Same metaphor applies. But it really is, I think, a question of just hiring good partners who are going to be sophisticated enough to represent your brand, and to the extent that you've got capable partners, they're going to know how to balance that out. It's subtlety. I believe that you don't want to hit anyone over the head, but you don't want to drive down the freeway and see a billboard and say, whose ad was that? Right?
So it's the balance between overwhelming, like you were saying, and being invisible. But I understand also what you're saying about how much is tacky, maybe. Just, yeah, how much is too much? And I think there's a balance and kind of an elegance of presentation that, yes, and we have talked about here where we're, you know, are you going to brand the toilet paper, you know? No. But it is nice to have some subtleties. One of the things that we have done is to just have a blind embossed a card with our winemaker notes, just with blind embossing. So in order to even see it, you kind of have to feel it, and it's really tactile. And so the paper is in there and beautiful. I also wanted to readdress the question of budget. I want to, in this little portfolio that's going around, there are numerous labels in there that were developed in a heartbeat and very inexpensively, and using some beautiful treatments, foil, color, and kind of a resonation of interesting things, and they were done really quickly. The fork, knife, and spoon you'll see in here, which was part of the table, And so we, you know, it was very, it happened so quickly, and it was very strong branding. So, yeah.
It may just back up also, just to reaffirm it. The question about what do you really want to do to start off, and I think to build on what Mindy said, is that you really, if you're selling, you have to be authentic to who you are and what you are, but the real art and science of this is being able to understand what is it that's relevant and important to you that you can then find and align with a market, an audience, that's not being done well that you can deliver. And then to carry beyond that, as far as logo is concerned, you don't want to put your name on anything that you don't, that you wouldn't be proud as that representing who you are and what you're all about. And perhaps the most important thing I can communicate today is that if you walk away with nothing else, to recognize that it's much, that your logo is only the bucket, it's the empty basket into which people start pouring their understanding of what that name and logo is. And everything you do and say relative to your promise is going to go into that empty basket. So what you want to do is be clear on, beyond the emotional value, what are the things that you really are going to be representing and where are you going to make those connections? So for example, even with this brand, you can even imagine the appeal to the people of the country and people who appreciate a simpler, rugged, authentic life. And that is something I think very much in parallel to this brand. So what more can they do, having horses on the property? Maybe they even offer horse rides or horse tours or things that surround that. But it's back to that authentic value of what that brand's all about. What is it about your brand, and what can you create that's going to be something that goes beyond the label and the logo? Because the logo is just the reference point to what your value is. And so you don't go to Google because of the logo. You don't buy a Mercedes because you saw a cool commercial, unless you learned something about the car that was something that was irrelevant or distinctive to you, right? So focus on how are you going to provide value that's relevant, that has both rational and emotional value, and then define a personality and a look and feel that reflects that, and then put your name and identity on that, only on those things that make sense. Even the choice of a promotional item, for example. So, like in the case of my company, we developed a little giveaway item, which is a USB drive that's in the shape of our symbol, and it's made out of stainless steel, and it's a USB drive, but it looks like a keychain. Well, our company is all about innovation and about not only form but function and form. And so I could have given away hats or T-shirts or anything else, but positioning, the choice is being deliberate and conscious about everything you do with every detail communicated. So that USB drive is a reflection of a company that's distinctive. I'm providing value to our clients because everyone needs a hard drive, and also, by the way, it's beautiful. And that's a reflection of what we want to be seen as: smart, small and powerful, thoughtful, innovative.
Right on. You have a question?
I think my opinion, I think the wine industry suffers from a lot of ego. and there's a lot of me pushing me out to this world that's going to love me. Right? And that's just kind of the reality. But I don't, personal opinion, don't see that as the future. Because if you look at the millennial group, I think their buying habits are very different. Yeah. We're kind of addressing a baby boomer group here, which is where the high-priced wines are being sold, but they're not. Yes. That's not going to continue into the millennial group. So I'm interested in your opinion on how do you recommend, as one of you, bringing in the consumer to validate this brand? At what point do you bring in your target market, make them part of the process so that you're not pushing your product to them, but you're actually creating product that resonates with them?
You go first, if you like. No,
go for it. I have to give some thought to that.
Well, I mean, it goes back to products are made in the factory and brands are made in the mind. Sales is, we're going to make this product and you're going to love it, right? Marketing is, what is it that really matters to you? So you're absolutely right. You want to understand that target out. You want to understand who you're selling to and even be deliberate about who it is you're going after, because there's an infinite audience. So positioning could be, you could focus on, you could be a specialty provider to a certain type of a restaurant, or to even a particular restaurant itself that happens to be a chain or happen to have many different brands. Or it could be a particular varietal? Do you focus on dessert wine, or you focus on a collection? In any way you can understand that, bringing in the customer is key. So that comes from just having conversations with your friends and peers, and if you are serious about it, you can get into talking to some of the retailers and the restaurateurs and leverage your relationships as a starting point. I mean, easy way is, having I hate to call it a focus group, because a focus group everyone may be influencing their own opinion, but taking people to lunch and just getting their point of view on what's important to them and what makes you really interested in buying a wine. Is it price? I mean, because you've got things that are like price, period, and millennials are probably more sensitive to it. And then when you get into more ego and the emotional side, it's really like the more you have all the special attention to detail, like that's going to appeal because it's going to be different, and people want to associate people's own ego and their own brand is built in this. We are all brands, and our brands are the sum of everything we associate with ourselves. So if I'm taking this box of wine around, I feel pretty darn special because there's only 200 and some cases of these things made a year, and I have the privilege of being able to drink a $230 bottle of wine. And that plays to ego, and it also plays to... But you can't charge $230 a bottle for a wine if you don't have Philippe Melquet, and you don't have the attention to detail. You don't have Mindy and everyone else reinforcing all those key values that make it so special and important.
I think...
Can we open some of this, maybe?
Yeah, I know. I brought an empty bottle.
I'm just kidding.
Shoot. Yeah, the experience, I think, is finding what experience do you want to... A similar experience that resonates with you that you want to put your own spin on it and your own unique experience related to something else that you resonate with that maybe somebody else has done also. So I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel in many ways, but you just have to, it has to be from you. It has to be authentic to you. Did you have a question? Okay.
What did you put on the back label, Lindsay?
Oh, very good question, because we were listening to Maria earlier.
Yeah.
I'm a minimalist, and so I think it's important. Obviously, there are mandatory things that we want on there, like Napa Valley. Pritchard Hill is not an appellation, but we can use it as a locator. So I put that on the back label, and a very one word, a very simple sentence on the back label. There's no varietal. There's varietal on the front, but it's 100% Cabernet. If we come up with a wine that's a blend, we will want to put the blend on the back. From my perspective, that's important. People want to know if there's Cabernet Franc in your wine. For a wine like this, and even for a wine like Lorenza, which is $20, that's my wine that I make. I don't think tasting notes are relevant, honestly. I think it's hard to say what I think this is going to taste like for you, but I do know that rosé goes great with shellfish. But I'm not going to say that on the back label. Hopefully you know that already. So that can go on the website, and in my, I can tweet about it and everything else surrounding it. But the back label is, you need to be quick about it. We all need glasses, right? It's dark in a restaurant. There's back labels are usually black. It's very hard to read. So to have a big, it's too long. So that's...
So no story. You didn't put any story on the head or horses or anything?
No. Because, I think the front label tells that story, right? I'll just read the back label on here.
I probably need to go outside and find the light. It says, from vines grown on Pritchard Hill, our serene, beautiful destination. And so on the property engraved in the stones are the three Japanese symbols for serenity, beauty, and oneness, which is a sense of place. And that was done by our landscape architect, who was Japanese. And so that kind of ties it in, but you have to come to Brand to know that. So there are little hints.
You brought up a really good point when you were talking about the restaurant being dark. Because when you said that, I thought, wait, there are two sort of ways you sell. Once you're in the restaurant, you bought it. So it doesn't really matter what you read on the back. But if it's on the shelf in the store, then it's a different story. So why don't you comment on that? As like, if your pitch is to get it on a shelf, you might want one thing in the store.
Yeah,
and the restaurant might not.
So it's all part of your marketing plan. Like for Lorenza, for example, we're building that brand by the glass. So we hope that Bouchon and everybody gets this wine by the glass. You get it, you pour it, it's beautiful. There's 5 glasses in that bottle. It's a wonderful thing. Brand, how much would a glass of brand cost at a restaurant?
$225.
Wow, really expensive. So that's not our market. Our market is getting people up to the winery, you know, spending time with them, having them enjoy the experience, and then they're at the customer.
So would you have something on the back label different if your approach was you wanted to have it in liquor stores? Or not?
From my point of view, I think the varietal, the blend is important. Website is super important. That must be on there somewhere. And a very short reason for this wine. Yeah.
It might be more about which wine shop do you want to be in that you would only entrust that they would be able to tell your story, right? Another example I think you played on I think is important as it relates to even the trade and as you get into it. Rheingold Beer was a client of ours years ago. And, I mean, that brand was, I mean, it was the brand for 50 years in the East Coast of New York. And, like, the original, Andy Warhol's paint can was actually going to be a Rheingold beer can, and it happened like he, Truman Capote, got in something, and the can got crushed, and it became... So that was a piece of folklore. The formula for light beer that became Miller Light Beer was actually developed by Joe Lades, the brewmaster at Rheingold, but when the company was sold and through transactions, it ended up at Miller Light ended up... That formula came... So those are the kind of stories, when you start telling, that there are substantive stories that are interesting stories that are tied to your brand. If you can come up with things that are meaningful and true and authentic, but also interesting, and things that, well, that's cool. And by associate anything that you can associate yourself with legitimately that is of relevance is going to be valuable.
You all have pretty good stories.
Yeah, for sure.
Argentina and you've had a vineyard and you're personal and how it's connected. I mean, it's a great story.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.